your favorite Grasslands PR team. Today, we're back with another episode of The Best Biome, where we take a look at the underappreciated and overlooked aspects of Grasslands.
Which we believe, personally, are the best biome.
Yes, obviously.
And we hope to convince you as well, dear listener. I'm Alan.
I'm Nicole.
I'm Rachel.
Hey, guys. Perfect. It only took... 5 minutes for us to figure out how to properly open this podcast. And I want to say there's some really positive energy just crackling in the air right now because we're about to talk about birds.
A bird that I think is pretty stinking cool. It only lives in grasslands and it has a lot of fascinating ancient history, which is like one of my favorite topics.
Ancient history.
Yeah.
Wow.
So buckle up, because today we're learning about the Sariema.
Sariema.
Sariema, which is a group of birds.
Mm-hmm.
There are two Sariemas in the world.
Oh.
Sariemas. Yes. Singular. Sariema. Plural.
What?
Let's move on.
I don't know. Look, there's a group of birds. They are called Sariemas. I don't think I don't fucking know.
Look. Believe it or not, it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon and not 3 a.m.
This is big 3 a.m. energy.
We're doing good. All right.
Okay.
Yes.
So the word Sariema refers to both two individual birds and also the group of birds. They're just called Sariemas. Sariemas. And they are ecologically very similar to the secretary bird.
Oh.
Do you guys know what a secretary bird is? Pop quiz time, go.
Yes.
Alan?
Secretary birds, they are very leggy.
It's true.
Very tall. Sort of like...
eyelashes.
Eyelashy. Yeah.
They have beautiful eyelashes.
Yes. They are they're sort of like almost like a ground-based sort of like raptor.
Mm-hmm.
Like they grab snakes, they just kick the heck out of them to death, and then they eat them. And they have like, I believe we talked about them briefly on this podcast.
I think so. I don't remember what episode.
Me either.
About how they got like just, you know, they can get bit by snakes all day.
Yeah.
And they're fine.
That's the thing.
Because there's just really no like, minimal circulatory system in their legs.
Right. Yeah, that's the one. Okay. Yeah. Yep. So secretary bird is an African species. And like you said, it's a leggy murder bot. And basically, the Sariema is the South American ecological equivalent to the secretary bird. They are not related species. Mm-hmm. They do have some convergent features, like their beautiful, luscious eyelashes. Mm-hmm. That is also a trait that the Sariema has.
Nice.
So you can kind of picture this bird. Like I said, there's two different species of Sariema. There's the black-legged and the red-legged Sariema. They're very similar. They're also honestly not super well studied compared to other species, which is just a component of our rich colonial history in the world and the fact that a lot of South American species have gone unstudied for many decades and didn't get studied until they arrived in zoos, for example, up in like Western areas, quote unquote. Hmm. Yeah, that's just a feature, not a bug, of what's gone on here with this animal. Yeah, so some of the data we have today is fairly new, and some of it goes way back.
Whoa.
Whoa.
In time.
Ancient history, as you said.
So if you haven't seen one of these birds, I'll describe the red-legged one to you. They're very similar. They have long legs. They are capable of flight. They don't fly very much. They primarily run around on the ground. And the red-legged Sariema has a sort of, it's not a crest, but they are long plumes at the front of the face, like between the beak and the forehead or the eyes that can raise up for display purposes. And you're more likely to see it. yeah, picture a secretary bird or like a very leggy turkey just kind of walking around eating eating snacks off the ground, basically. Yeah. They are omnivorous. And they are some of the largest ground-dwelling birds endemic to the Neotropics. The only group of birds that's larger than the Sariemas are rheas.
Okay. Yeah, that's big. Yeah.
Yeah. So they are among the largest birds in the Neotropics for ground-dwelling birds. And they are a hunting bird that specializes in killing snakes and lizards, like our secretary bird friend. And here's where it gets kind of weird, because this little bird is the only surviving cousin to terror birds.
Ooh, okay.
And so they have some really unique in the world today features that are shared only by terror birds in the past. And, you know, some bird groups are susceptible to gigantism. This is one of them. So even though the Sariema is a pretty small bird, like the lineage that they belong to is enormous and gets up into like the 10-foot tall range of like horrifying animals. So pretty cool. Also, it is the only truly cursorial, which means running, bird predator, in that it like needs to chase down its prey. So it has some interesting features in that aspect too. I don't know why the secretary bird isn't considered to be like a true cursorial predator, since that's my perception of them. Maybe they're more strong flyers. Maybe they don't chase down their prey, or that's not like a necessary part of their ecology or physiology. But because of this feature, it makes this bird a really interesting comparison to a lot of extinct early birds and avian dinosaurs, because most of those ancient birds or bird-like animals were also cursorial. And so some of the features that we see in a Sariema could be convergently evolved to fulfill that cursorial, like ground-based predator aspect.
Nice.
For example, the extensible sickle claw that it has, like a velociraptor.
Yes. The kind that Dr. Alan Grant wore around his neck on a necklace.
Indeed, yes. With one slice.
Yeah.
Eviscerate you, et cetera. Yeah. So a pretty unique bird and a grasslands endemic. So let's talk about them first. And then I'm going to tell you about terror birds.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to tell you about like baby murder, probably.
Sure. Fantastic.
You know, that's part of it.
So the sort of habitat this animal lives in, as you might imagine, is really open. It is typical grasslands, but they sort of fill the ecological range of like pure plains up into like just open woodlands, basically. So savannas, grassland, all grassland types in South America. And they're in the area of Brazil and Argentina and a couple of the other countries around that area. Like I said, they are capable of flight. They have a keel and everything. They are not strong flyers, though. You're much more likely to see them on the ground. And when they do fly, it's probably more like little short bursts to get up into a tree to roost or to get up into their nests. They do nest in trees. Or sometimes even to escape predators. But honestly, for this animal, it's more likely to run away if possible. It would only, in desperation, attempt to fly to get away from a predator. It's more likely to go speedy fast.
Yeah. How fast can they go?
I just realized I didn't know.
Wow.
How fast is
that?
What's your guess?
That's faster than I thought.
30 miles an hour.
Dang. 25.
Up to 40.
Dang. That is fast.
Yeah.
It's quite quick.
Very fast. That's actually the same statistic I had for terror birds, which is crazy. Maybe I'm getting them mixed up. Hang on. It's a bad look to have to Google things while I'm recording. God, yeah. Okay, so it looks like most species were of terror birds were more aligned with like 30 miles an hour. Dang. But there's, I mean, that's a huge group. So there's a lot of variation in there, and especially size variation and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yes, Adiama has a really fast animals, obviously, and really at home on the ground. So one of the things that makes this animal the most unique is the way that it murders things.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. Have you guys seen, I know you have, Nicole, have you seen a Adiama?
Yeah, I believe, because I have seen like I've seen videos of like Sariema enrichment in zoos, and I believe it involves, they basically punch something to death with their face. Like, it's pretty spectacular to watch. But yeah, they just like, and pick it up and like throw it down, and like, because they'll like, they'll pick, like pick up the little ball and then they'll like, and then chuck it on the ground, like body slam it.
Yes. Yeah,
it's pretty fun.
And that's one of their natural behaviors. So, you know, they're trained to do that in the sense that they're trained to do their natural behavior on cue, and they will chuck anything, a rubber alligator, like a rubber snake, whatever. And that is the characteristic thing about both Sariemas and terror birds that makes them exceptionally unique in the bird world, because their bodies are built for that like really sharp up and down, almost hatchet like movement. Mm-hmm. And there's really nothing else in the bird world, at least, that does that. I know we're thinking like, oh, well, woodpeckers, I guess, like drum, but that's a very different locomotion than what we're talking about. Sure. And this is meant exclusively for, like Alan said, punching animals with their faces and chucking them at the ground. So, yeah, it's an extremely unique behavior. And because they're preying a lot on small reptiles, when they grab this lizard or snake, they basically beat it to death on the ground by grabbing it into their beak and slamming it on the ground over and over again. And they will not only do this to sort of like break the animal like down emotionally or mentally, you know, just to get it to stop like fighting back, break its willpower and its ability to resist. Uh-huh. But they'll also do it to break its bones and the other parts of the
body. I assumed it was more for killing it rather than, you know, savoring its agony.
Well, I think I maybe described it wrong. I was thinking I should have used the word stunning the animal.
There we go.
Okay. I mean, who knows?
No, it's, I mean, that's
if a bumblebee can feel emotions, I bet Sariemas can too, and they delight in torture.
It's a great, it really does break the spirit a bit to be slammed on the ground over and over again.
For sure.
Sure.
If this prey, and they are hunting like primarily small things, so we're not talking about a bird that's jumping on the backs of maned wolves and trying to murder them or anything. They're catching little guys.
Sure.
And if the prey is too large to swallow, they will then like stand on it and like get it, you know, pinned down basically. And they will use then their hatchet like beak to tear it apart and shred it. Nice. And as much as they're able to just like hurl things at the ground with shocking velocity, they're also able to rip upwards with an equal ferocity that is, once again, pretty unique in the bird world. Like, that sort of up and down, like, just hatchet motion is wild. So a lot of force goes into that, like, shredding of meat.
Nice.
Yeah.
Are there bills like specially adapted, like what's the I can't picture the shape of a Sariema bill.
They're fairly flat. Okay. Actually, they might have like a very faint hook. It's not like, I mean they definitely have a hook on the end of the beak. It's nothing super spectacular. I'll show you. I mean, it's maybe more pronounced than like, it's more pronounced than something like a shrike would have. So, I mean, it fits in line with, like, that predatory bird shape you'd expect.
Yeah.
Sure. It's fairly long.
I feel like a secretary bird has a more hooked, traditionally hooked beak, right? Mm-hmm. Or no?
Yeah, Secretary Bird has much more of like a hawk-like mm-hmm. face. Right. And I think the difference is honestly just the length of the bill.
Sure.
So that the fact that, yeah, the Sitama's bill is like more elongated before it hits that hook mm-hmm. makes it seem, I don't know, like a less powerful long eagle beak, mm-hmm. basically.
Sure.
It's not very wide. Yeah, oh, what a pretty bird. Mm. Oh, so good. So good.
I have a... Sorry, I just remembered that I have a collection of drawings on sticky notes that of us being killed by various grassland animals.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And you did draw a picture of Nicole getting slammed by a Sariema headfirst into the ground.
I don't remember that. That's awesome.
I could go with the visual aid for this episode.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or was I Prairie Dogs and Rachel was Sariema?
I thought I was getting eaten by a prairie dog.
Oh, maybe.
And then Rachel was getting eaten by a snake of some sort.
Yes, that seems right.
Yeah.
Anyway, neither here nor there. Just something I remembered.
Yeah.
Doesn't everybody have collections of their friends being gruesomely murdered by grassland animals?
Yeah.
On sticky notes on their wall somewhere.
Yeah. Only the cool ones.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's like the basics of a Sitama. Their life history is not like super spectacular, so I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time just like basically reading their entire life history to you. What's far more interesting to me is how these things we've talked about relate to their ancestral terror birds and the ways that like both are informing the other in that sense. So let's talk about what a terror bird is and why that makes this extant bird, this bird that still exists today on the planet, so cool and unique. So how much do you know about terror birds?
They're big.
Yeah.
They're big.
That's like pretty much it.
And I would infer scary.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
There was one on Madagascar. At least one.
Interesting.
I know. We'll come it's back really to weird.
That. Yeah, that is very weird.
Very weird.
most of them, okay, so they, in terms of like time, existed somewhere in the Eocene to the lower Pleistocene. So they did exist for a period of time before grasslands existed, but they definitely existed into the formation of grasslands and spread during the formation of grasslands. Mm-hmm. So they have a little bit of a history there. They are also, almost all of them, extinct. And technically, while the Sariema is related to terror birds, it is not a terror bird. It's like in a sister tree in the same like little family. So they're related even though they're not technically like the true terror birds. Mm-hmm. And during this time when terror birds evolved, South America was basically an island that was completely unique to itself. There were no land bridges. It was isolated from placental mammals. And during the period after dinosaurs, terror birds were one of those groups of birds that continued to go on and not only thrive in the post-dinosaur world, but often fill the sort of ecological niche that was left behind by dinosaurs in this area.
Okay.
Very fun.
Yeah. So picture birds, you know, from like Sitama size, like little, you know, couple feet tall to like 10 feet tall birds. Just absolutely monstrous, living mostly in Argentina. We do have some fossils in Hawaii, Florida, and Texas, as well as some controversial remains in other parts of the world. And we know that they are very carnivorous. So again, this is a group of birds that was a running animal that was carnivorous and therefore filling a lot of those dinosaur niches. And we know that they're carnivorous not only from, you know, evidence of the sort of forensic variety where it's like, ooh, we can tell that they were like eating this animal because we found it like dead embedded in the animal, which is true. more on that later. But we also have found like fossilized pellets from them. So we have remains that they've coughed up, like an owl pellet, basically. And so we can study what they were eating in that way too.
Nice. Yeah.
I didn't realize that like fossilized pellets were a really common thing in paleontology. Makes sense that they would be. But yeah, I was like, what? Pellet? How many pellets do we have from a lot, it turns out. We have a lot of ancient bird pellets. So extremely carnivorous. And they came in two different types. There's like the type that you would think of when you think of a terror bird, which is like the big, meaty-legged, huge animal with this monstrous head. Yeah. And then there's also like a more sort of dainty type of terror bird, which instead of having that like big chunky like dodo like head, I don't know, that's not the only way. Does that make sense? Yeah. Big,
that's
thick
what I was picturing.
It looks a lot more like something like a Sidiama. It looks more similar, and those are the more primitive types of terror birds. So really they ran the gambit in like size and in terms of like their flight capability and the way that they were specialized. So a lot of variation there. Two things that all terror birds have in common are, number one, they have completely akinetic skulls. I'll tell you what that means in a second. And number two, they have super weird pelvises. That's not what I wrote down, but like a unique structure in the pelvis that is basically like a running adaptation. Okay. So what does an akinetic skull mean? I'm glad you asked. Most birds can actually flex part of their face. Like their beak is capable of movement, and they can open their mouth a little bit on the top mandible. It's like picture a bird opening its mouth. It's not just like the lower hinge opening and closing. Mm-hmm. It is that the upper beak can flex a little bit. And that's reflected in the bones. So you can see that there's areas of the bones where it's like not really hinged, but that's a good analogy. It's sort of like flattened and thinned out. And so there's what they call flexion zones where they have some mobility.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's not true for terror birds.
Okay.
It is true for the Sidiama. But it's not true for terror birds. That's one of the reasons why we know that they're like a sister and not a direct descendant. So basically, these things have giant meaty skulls that can't flex, that makes their slamming their faces into their prey more effective.
So
there's multiple flexion zones around the face. They have really scientific names, so I didn't write them down.
So like what parts of the are we talking about, like the palate, like what
are the palate, the cheeks, there's like a nasal one, there's like different zones in the face. And in terror birds, I think that there are no flexion zones at all. Like there is sometimes variation in how many flexion zones there are in certain animals. Mm-hmm. Certain birds, rather, but in terror birds, they have none at all, completely without movement or akinetic.
So, okay, I got you.
Also better for ripping faces off backwards with extreme force.
Nice.
Since they are applying such intense force to their skull, like what, you know, what, like, do they have some kind of like,
like cushion for their brain?
Yeah, like I mean, like I mean, like woodpeckers
That's
do,
such
right?
A good question.
You know, woodpecker tongues, you know, sort of
gross.
Well, they sort of, you know, encompass the skull and sort of pre-create a little bit of a, you know, a buffer.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question, and I either that hasn't been studied or it's not a structure that exists. Like I looked at a lot of studies by there's one researcher named Federico or Dino DeGrange, and he studies a lot of things about the brain and senses of these animals and a lot about like the kinetic movements of these animals. Talked a lot in interviews about the way that what we know about how their brains function mm-hmm. never mentioned any cushioning at all. So if there was something like that, it's either not known or it's not been studied. Okay. We have studied extensively, though, the kinds of forces that their skulls can withstand and compared it to other birds that are still alive, like eagles and seriemas. Mm-hmm. And we do know that their skull is extremely good at withstanding the forces and pressures of like up and down movements, so like pulling and smashing forwards, mm-hmm. but very, very weak in side to side motions. So they can get like sucker punched in the side of their head and then they'll be hurting. Yeah. Whereas they can sucker punch something else with the front of their face and they'll be fine.
Nice.
Sure. Okay.
Which is, yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, sure, yeah. I am so concerned about their brains.
I'm sure they're fine. I'm actually, sure they're their fine brains too, are apparently really good. We know a weird amount about their brains, which kind of throws me off a little bit because it's like we've studied so much about this animal that doesn't exist anymore, mm-hmm. and we have so much to learn about this bird that does still exist. Plot twist, that is one of the points of my episode here, is like we're studying so much about this fully dead extinct bird mm-hmm. and we're just now, like in the last year, learning why a seriema has a sickle claw. Yeah. Like what? Okay, anyway.
gosh.
Yeah, so that's their beak stuff. Okay. Unique structure in pelvis, just a fun thing. They basically have like an extra structure. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know what it's supposed to look like, you know, uh-huh. like, so I don't know. Basically, they have a sort of like a guardrail in place that keeps their femur facing forward and stops it from rotating out to the side.
All right.
Okay. So they don't like twist their leg in a weird
yeah.
direction.
Yeah. Okay. And basically, it keeps the legs pointing forward for right. a running gait and stops lateral movements. So it's really meant to maximize running forwards. Yep. And that's known in all terror birds. It's described as being very similar to something like a moa, which is another extinct, much more recently extinct, large ground-dwelling bird.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the things that make you go, ah, that's a terror bird.
Right. Huge, meaty skull and guardrailed pelvis.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's 10 feet tall.
Well, not all of them. Some of them are little.
Okay. Well, it's pretty big. It's a big chicken. Uh-huh.
Yeah. What was the biggest one?
Yeah, what was the biggest one?
They're just constantly finding new ones.
Those paleontologists.
There are several that are huge, honestly. As far as like, I think probably Titanus is the one everybody's most familiar with. I think that there's probably been more recently discovered ones that may be larger. But Titanus probably is the one you're thinking of if you're thinking of a terror mm-hmm. bird in your mind. And then there's another one that's pretty commonly talked about. What's the name of that one? Kellenkin. Most of what we know about them is from bone records, so mm-hmm. we don't have like a lot of other information about them, bone records and pellets.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. So yeah.
Anyway,
okay. Mm-hmm. So their brains are fine, you're telling me. I can't Probably. Get past this. Their brains are fine. Despite hammering them into living things on a daily basis.
Yes.
And just rapturously mm-hmm. slamming their face against... okay, that's fine.
Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, they have a brain mm-hmm. that is really highly tuned
yeah.
to visual stimuli. So that's like one of the things we know for sure about them. They had like mm-hmm. very active brains, which... is kind of in alignment with the entire idea of the evolution of flight altogether, right? There's this idea that those fast-moving ground-dwelling birds being highly visual led to the sort of like flight-ready brain that we see in these animals. So that's consistent with how birds evolved. And these guys, sure. you know, although a lot of them did lose their ability to fly, they still had that extremely active, visually adept mind, and all the features of those highly visual types of birds. I will say that they do have complete wings. All terror birds had complete wings. They're just a little bit reduced. And they're not just for displays, like the way you'd think of an ostrich having wings just for displays. Like, all terror birds still have a keel and, like, flight muscles. Mm-hmm. Some of them just lost the ability to actually fly as, like, a derived feature. So some of them absolutely could fly, probably a lot like how the Sariyama can fly today, which is not relying on it, but fully capable of doing it for small bursts of time.
That does make them infinitely scarier.
And that some of them could fly?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah, I don't think the biggest ones, like the Titanuses yeah, yeah. and stuff, they probably, no, mm-hmm. none of those ones could fly. But they did still also have, like, completely pneumatized bones. So their bones are hollow. They're just mm-hmm. extremely dense okay. and heavy. Hollow bones.
Interesting.
Yes, 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 yes.
Well, because, like, okay, from the, like, an evolutionary perspective, like, that sort of coursing movement, sprinting mm-hmm. along the ground, predates that is what predates flight and the yeah. development of wings.
Like, yes, the development of wings for flight. Yeah.
So then they kind of piggybacked off of that movement, because they already had, like, the hips were already, like, in the right position for running for a lot
for
of
sure
things.
Yeah. And the bipedal movements, the running, yeah, it's been pretty well accepted in the paleontological community that before birds could ever fly, they had these extremely visually active, flight-ready brains that were ready to process that information and move quickly.
Okay. Do feathers predate flight?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. Because they're flightless, they're non-flying dinosaurs that yeah. were feathered.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Right. And a lot of coverings on dinosaurs are outside of the bird lineages, too. So, mm-hmm. In fact, I think a famous paleontologist once said the question shouldn't be why didn't alligators develop feathers, but, like, why did they lose them? Mm-hmm. You know, like, right. the genes for making feathers go beyond just dinosaurs even and into sister groups to dinosaurs like pterosaurs and mm-hmm. other very ancient reptiles that are not at all dinosaurs.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, all the machinery was there before flight developed, and the terror birds as a group just lost the ability to fly and maintained a lot of those features that we see in those ground-dwelling hunting avian dinosaurs.
Nice.
And the need to chase prey and be, like, super responsive to the environment in that high, fast-moving sort of pace is something that's pretty unique. And we can absolutely see it in the brains of these animals. And the researchers who study terror birds like to point out that we really don't see anything in terms of this type of structure and lifestyle in the bird world anywhere except for the Sariyama. So it's extremely unique. They also – I don't know how they know this, but Dino said that their brains are optimized for gait stabilization. Huh. I don't know how you can figure that. Yeah, I guess it's like the portions of the brain. I don't know. Some sort of ancient forensics you can do to determine that the part of the brain that's there for, like, stabilization and stuff is really good. But
okay. Yeah, sure.
I guess that makes sense if you're an animal that's like – sorry, that was uh-huh. not good for an audio medium.
She is miming with her hand the motion of picking something up and slamming it against the ground over and over again.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. yeah. And then, you know, finally, the way that they kill prey is extremely unique and directly relates to their living relatives. So these hatchet-like strikes and then extreme pullback forces, that's something that we really only see in this group of birds. And it's been described this fast drawback motion is very much like a snapping motion mm-hmm. that they were capable of. And importantly, it looks like the musculature of the neck and how that connects to the brain. The head. I was thinking about brains. Uh-huh. Really isn't built for lateral movements. Like they're not strong in like the way that their heads can rotate or move to the side. They're really structurally sound and strong at specifically slamming forward and ripping back.
Okay.
Super unique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good slamming faces.
It's just like the it's like a very specific investment in one strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Indeed.
That is, interesting to think about their musculature because it is such, like, they have a long neck. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like they're super beefy, like, you know, farther up on their neck. So, interesting. You have to be selective.
But it's like you can see it in the skeletal structure. Sure, like, the people who have, like, done these analyses on the way that, like, the motion must have happened based mm-hmm. on muscle attachments, it's like, specifically extremely robust in those two areas.
Yeah.
So why don't we have terror birds anymore is an interesting question. And why is the Sariema the only terror bird relative that still exists today? And that is highly debated. It's also even debated how long they lasted. So I mentioned that they definitely existed from like the lower Eocene to the lower Pleistocene. But that's pretty debated. Like there's a controversial fossil that was found in Uruguay that's possibly 17,000 years old, which puts it way earlier than like the 2 million estimate that we can safely say, like we know for sure they were alive then. There's also a lot of controversial fossils in other parts of the world. Like it seems like, when the American continents connected, we maybe exported some of our terror birds, not only to North America, but into Europe and maybe Africa.
Yeah.
But again, it's highly debated whether these are in fact terror birds or if they're just superficially similar things that share certain structures. And so that's pretty controversial. And there's evidence for both interpretations. But, you know, conservatively, they disappeared like 2-ish million years ago, if we're being safe. Of course, that might change as we develop a better understanding. And it sort of converges with when the continents connected. Okay. So the popular theory for a long time was that the placental mammals from North America came down and basically outcompeted these massive predators. And due to that competition, terror birds went extinct. But that's a weirdly simplistic view when at the same time it's also true that we had terror birds coming up from South America into North America where, you know, home of the placental mammals and doing extremely well for very long periods of time and like, you know, hunting horses in Texas and having a great time of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So the timing is a little bit off and it definitely seems like under some conditions they could absolutely compete with other predators. According to some scientists, the better hypothesis is that maybe they just got too specialized was the issue. And so their really specialized hunting techniques for specialized prey is what made that flood of new animals, you know, difficult to compete with. And the sudden changes that occurred when the continents connected made it so that suddenly a lot of them were going extinct. But yeah, we don't really know for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I love when there's like one fossil found where we don't expect it and it just turns everything on its head. Like
it's so good. And when you have so few fossils to begin with, that makes it like especially interesting. Like, we only have two fossil examples of what we'd consider to be actual, like, Sergama groups or, like, actual ancient Sergamas. And it looks like they haven't changed for a long time. So they've been pretty similar for a long time. But, yeah, that's, like, two fossils that we have. We don't have a ton of terror bird fossils. There are some terror birds that we have. I think the most complete skeleton is, like, 80-something percent complete. They're missing, like, some foot bones and, like, one of the hands or something like that.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Is there something about, like, the topography or, like, the soil of South America that makes fossils hard to find? Or
I don't know. I honestly think it has to do with colonialism a lot and just the types of science that has happened in South America or not happened in South America.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I don't know. And a lot of the fossils that we have that are fairly old, you know, they're found in museum drawers with notes like, found this in this hill. And it's like, okay, well, like, what strata? Like, where did this come from? The 17,000-year-old one is like that, where it's like, we just found this in a drawer with some very vague notes about where it was located. So we can't say with any guaranteed certainty, like, what age it was.
Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know that we have as many examples.
Gotcha.
And I don't fully know why that is. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's frustrating.
We're also, again, just to remind you, just now learning things about the animals that still live there right now. So
yeah.
yeah, and that's not, you know, for a lack of like work with these animals in South America. I think it's just that like the Western world is just now catching up and caring. And so that's why the Western world is just now finding out things or, you know, funding research and that sort of thing.
Well, sure. It seems so strange to have the extinct species studied more than the extant species, especially since if it's like a modern analog for, you know, these like terror birds and things like that, why is that, you know, why hasn't more time not been devoted to understanding the Sergama and then inferring about the terror bird from that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It kind of blows my mind. Like, I know that there's been some old studies about, like, old as in like 2010, 2006, that looked at the skull structure, like we talked about, and whether it can withstand forces and stuff. But I wanted to talk about the sickle claw next because I think that's super interesting. And the use of the sickle claw in the Sergama was only just described January 2023.
Wow.
So literally like a month ago from when we're recording this right now. Or not, a year ago.
Yes.
sorry, this month a year ago is when they first published a description of how that animal uses its sickle claw.
Wow.
Which like, we've been talking about how velociraptors and Deinonychus and all these other animals, like every dromaeosaur that exists has one of these things. And a lot of other ancient non-dromaeosaur early birds has a sickle claw. It's always been like, well, how do they use them? We literally have a live bird today that has one. Like it's, they have one. Like, how do they use it? We've only described it last year.
Weird.
Wild.
Isn't that crazy?
Hmm.
Ooh. And the only way they described it, just to get a little rant here, was they went to some zoos in North America and worked with zookeepers in North American zoos to watch the behavior of how these things were feeding. They didn't even go to South America and actually study birds in the wild. They were just like, let's go to some zoos up here in Florida or wherever. I don't know which state it was in. Some American state.
Okay.
You know, like, what? Wild. What? What? okay. Anyway, I'm getting hated. study, like, ancient birds are super cool. I agree. Like, I love ancient birds. It's one of my favorite topics. We literally have one here that's alive. Like, let's learn everything we can about it. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, anyway, we did. So we do know some things about the sickle claw. Let me tell you about that because I think it's super cool. One of the things you should know, and I may have shown you a picture of it before. Here's like an example of what it looks like. You can see it's, they call it the second digit. That's only because the one on the back that's like a thumb is technically the first.
Right.
So it's the inside claw, just like a dromaeosaur or a velociraptor or whatever. And it is sickle-like, extremely curved, perpetually sharp, and held up off the ground is what makes it a sickle claw. Now, the thing that makes it a sickle claw is a little bit different from dromaeosaurs because for them, a lot of it is like super hyperextended toe bones. Mm-hmm. These guys have a foot pad that holds it upright.
Okay.
So that's how they're able to keep it up off the ground anyway. And there's, again, been a lot of debate over how these things might have been used in ancient dinosaurs. So they all hunt on the ground, the animals that have this claw, especially the basal animals. So it's been theorized that it was used to gut animals, like Dr. Alan Grant said, mm-hmm. to slice and tear. There have been hypotheses that it's used to hold down prey, like to pin and grasp prey. Mm-hmm. Really popular theory is that it was used like a grappling hook, which I hold on, stay with me. Uh-huh. They don't mean that they like threw it across the room, but rather, you know, if you picture paleo art of Deinonychus or Velociraptor like animals jumping on a triceratops or something, mm-hmm. They might take those sickle claws to basically hold on and get a grip.
Seems like a good way to lose a toe.
Well, except if you think about like modern predatory cats and how mm-hmm. they use their extensible claws, mm-hmm. it's in a really similar way where they kind of like, you know, they can choose to extend it forward,
sure.
which is the same as these birds. Right. And they might use it to just grip and hold onto their prey while they take it out with their teeth or something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the thought is that ancient and perhaps modern birds may have used it as a grappling hook to hang onto animals while using their teeth or hatchet-like beak to murder them. Mm-hmm. And this actually has some fossil evidence behind it, and it may still be true. For example, there is a terror bird that was fossilized in death with its sickle claw embedded in a protoceratops. Yeah, there is some fossil evidence for that. How does a Sirigaima use their sickle claw? Mm-hmm. They use it not to grapple snakes, uh-huh. but to pin it down. Yeah. So, and this is actually kind of cool. Like there's in the study that was published in freaking 2023, they have like this photo where they show you that they're like, they've like hooked the claw around something mm-hmm. to hold it down, which is kind of cool. I don't know why nobody's ever observed that before.
Yeah. That seems pretty easy to observe. Like we know how they hunt. Why do we not know how they eat? Like,
it's much easier to see a hatchet than to ask questions about their toes. I don't know, man.
Fascinating.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, they're in tall grass, you know, sometimes. So
I guess.
You just can't see their feet.
So I mean, that's a good point. Pin and stabilize prey while they hammer it.
Yeah, while they hammer or tear to shreds.
Nice.
Sure. Yeah. So it is used primarily to restrain prey. I just want you to know that in the paleontological world, this hypothesis is called the Ripper hypothesis.
Nice.
Which is, Ripper stands for Raptor Prey Restraint Hypothesis. And they always make sure to put in parentheses, like, just so you know, it's pronounced Ripper.
Oh, they're so cool.
Some paleontologists say that the Sirigaima's sickle claw use is perhaps the best evidence for Deinonychus using the Ripper technique and other animals using it too. But, you know?
Yes.
Could be multi-purpose too. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Could be.
We can only guess with ancient birds and until very recently modern birds.
That's wild.
So terror birds, were they also, I mean, hunting, like what size prey were they hunting, terror birds?
Oh, like little horses and stuff like that.
Just little horses. Yeah. just grappling yeah. little horses and then ripping yeah, yeah, yeah. them to death.
Okay. For sure, for sure. Cool, yeah, cool, they were cool. hunting a lot of different mammal prey. They really kept alive that fear of large, terrifying bipedal feathered beasts
sure.
that the dinosaurs naturally you know, started. So yeah.
Okay. So the proportionally Sirigaima prey much smaller.
Much smaller than the stuff other like large terror bird types were hunting. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Just yeah. as like a fraction of a proportion of body size.
Yeah.
Terror birds were going for much larger things.
Yeah, in that example with the protoceratops, the animal that was hunting it, that terror bird was not like that much larger than it.
Yeah.
So
dang.
Yeah. Pretty exciting stuff.
Really, yeah. Yeah.
And I don't think we know if they hunted in groups or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's just conjecture. We also, interestingly, don't know anything about parental care for terrapins. We literally have no baby terrapins preserved at all. No eggs, no babies, no like ontology at all. Is ontology right?
Yes. Oh. Recapitulates phylogeny.
Yes. Okay. My brain was trying to convince me that oncology was the right word, but that's definitely not. Yeah, that's definitely a different thing that's in my brain. Okay, cool. Yep. Fantastic. We don't know anything about how terrapins raise their babies, but just to keep the terror alive, mm-hmm. as a final note here, how does the Sariema raise its babies? Well, like most birds, it, you know, raises them in a nest and feeds them and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in 2021, again, very weirdly recent stuff, a wild cejado red-legged Sariema was observed with its brood of three murdering one of its own babies and then ripping it to shreds and eviscerating it,
sure,
to feed it to its two siblings.
Nice.
Just selecting for,
heard a little cough, was like, nope, none of that.
Yep, none of that. And you know, like, murdering like one of the young in your brood is not an unheard of trait in birds. Not, yeah. So it's like, oh, you know, this could be, we don't know. It's only been observed one time.
Yeah.
So if it's a regular behavior, it could probably just be one of those situations like other birds that do this, where brood reduction is conserving resources and ensuring the survival of the two strongest chicks, et cetera. But it is pretty terrifying to think that your parent could murder you and feed you to your siblings, then maybe snack on you a little bit themselves with its sickle claw and its hatchet-like beak.
Yeah.
And whether or not terrapins also engage in behavior like this is impossible to say. So
indeed.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why there's so few fossilized.
New hypothesis.
Yes. No juvenile fossils, because if you weren't cutting it, you got eaten immediately.
Indeed.
By your own parents.
Yeah. Yes.
Was this a wild? You said this was an observation in the wild. Cool.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think we count like captive observations as necessarily being wild behavior, but we did say that with the sickle claw. So,
yeah.
I guess it's different. I mean, it's when it's more of a core physiological thing than necessarily a behavior, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
They probably eat the same in the wild and in captivity, but.
Right. It's not they're going to come up, improvise a new way to use their claw to, you know, like, oh, they use their sickle claw to tap on the glass of their enclosure to, you know.
To like, get more treats.
Yes. Yes.
Give me that alligator and I'm going to throw it around.
Tap. Okay. Interesting. Well, you know, hey, that's just very pragmatic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Infanticide.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Can't fault them for it, I guess.
Yeah.
You know? Mm.
That's very true. Well, guys, that is the Sariema. And terrapins.
What a fascinating beast. A reminder to all aspiring scientists that if you want to study dinosaurs, consider studying birds, because there's lots of birds that need more studying, and the birds are actually here.
Yeah.
We love dinosaurs. Yeah. We love dinosaurs. Love them. We love so paleontology, much. But there are birds.
Right.
They are dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
They're here.
Yeah.
They're flying around your house. They want to be known.
What? Hang on. Hang on. Let's go a step back. It is kind of wild to me. Thinking in some sort of future world, like if this bird did go extinct, suddenly the entire world would be like, we have to figure out what it was doing. We have to know everything about it. Like,
yeah. What is the allure of like, oh, it's, you know, trying to reconstruct the mysteries of the past, but it's like,
I mean, maybe that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just, you know, how about we understand the present? The mysteries of the present are also compelling.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you feel less cool if you just watch something happen versus
make forensically up, possibly.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Make a good guess. It's not just making stuff up. But.
I guess if you study paleontology, you are, you know, you can do so in it with a sort of objectivity of it being, you know, there's no impetus to conserve the species or protect the species or use the information in a way that is going to, you know, result in, you know.
Yeah. Mm. It's just for like your own fun knowledge.
It's like biology, but purely theoretical, you know.
Theoretical
like,
biology.
Like ecology, but like, oh, I don't have to think about.
How sad it is that this animal's going to be gone in 10 years.
Right. Or we don't have to think. We don't have to think about human impacts or like, you know, anything like that. It's just like, this is fantasy land without a landscape without humans.
Yeah. We don't have to think about big oil and gas and how we're going to plead for the survival of this species. Yes. Yeah. Very true.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Not that that's an issue for this specific animal. I genuinely don't think that's. Well, they are a Sahata
species, right?
Yeah.
Hmm.
What does that mean?
I mean, you know, there's pressures on the Sahara.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's so, more like soybeans and less like oil and gas, but yeah, true. For sure.
Equally insidious, the soybean. Well, Rachel.
Yeah.
Fascinating information about a fascinating animal.
Thank you.
Listeners, I invite you to attempt to get in the mind of Sariema this evening. Hold down your food upon your plate with one finger and violently rip at it in an up and down motion.
With your teeth?
With your teeth.
Obviously. That might rip your teeth out.
Yeah. What? What are you eating?
I don't know. It depends on what you're eating, I guess. I think if it's like
corn on the cob, you can handle it, you know?
I don't think I could.
How do you eat corn on the cob except for biting it and ripping it?
Slowly and carefully and without a lot of pressure and force.
Bite it and then rip back violently to tear the corn away.
Not too many times in a row, though. You might bruise your brain.
I already lost one tooth to a Crunchwrap Supreme. I'm not going to risk it with a corn on the cob.
But you were just doing normal biting things. So, like, you know. No we proof know that this Sariema way of eating. She might have
slammed that Crunchwrap with her face.
Yeah, that's the untold part of the story.
Nobody else was there. You don't know. Yeah.
Terrific.
Can I just say? I, like, looked it up just to make sure I wasn't, like, I didn't hallucinate this memory. But, like, even the Birds of the World page for the red-legged Sariema, very short. Mm-hmm. They don't even mention the sickle claw or anything.
Yeah.
That is incredible. Especially there, you will find Birds of the World accounts that are shockingly in-depth.
Oh, yeah.
That is interesting. And especially since, you know, the more you would think the more conspicuous, the more wide-ranging, the, you know, larger, the more charismatic whatever a bird is, the better studied it would be. Mm-hmm. Not in this case.
Right, yeah, which is wild. And I mean, the reason I didn't spend a lot of time talking about their natural history is because I didn't really find anything to be, like, especially like, oh, wow. It was just like, well, we sure know the basic facts about this animal. Like, what, that's so weird to me. And I do want to impress upon you that this is not a rare bird. Like, it's not threatened at all, least concern. It's, like, hanging out, like, everywhere in the Cerrado and in other grasslands. It's so common. Like, when I was in Brazil, we saw them eating pieces of bread out of somebody's back porch. Like, they were just, like, throwing bread out and was like, oh, yep, they come by every day to eat the bread. And I was like, oh, that's a unique, quirky little thing that probably only happens here. No, like, it's so common that they mention it, like, on the Wikipedia page. Like, oh, yeah, people feed them bread and stuff. And they'll just come up to your house. And it's, like, a really common thing that happens everywhere. It's like, this is, like, people interact with them on a regular basis in a totally normal way. So
what if this is a you know, what if this is like a jungle of the mind situation where it's like we have an association of like this, you know, this like cold, detached predator that like is still like a lingering evolutionary fear. Like we need to stay away from the Sariema.
Maybe. But it's just like a pigeon.
But it's like a murder pigeon, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like something about that is uncanny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what else I wonder is how much of this is just like nobody bothered to ask the people who live around them. For and sure. We're could just like, be, we discovered this new thing in 2023. And it's like, I'm sure if you asked like any grandma in Brazil, True. Who lives in the Cejado, they'd be like, oh yeah, they use it to hang on to their prey. Like,
yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I when I throw them bread, I see them use their sickle claw.
They keep to pin it down and yeah. they rip it to shreds.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's that's a good point. Just yeah. because it is undescribed does not mean it's unobserved.
Right, exactly.
By any measure.
But because it's like undescribed, mm-hmm. everybody acts like they have no idea what the hell's going on with this animal, and our articles about it are mm-hmm. abysmal. Anyway, that was just a little side note. Mm-hmm.
Side note received. Thank you. The Best Biome is produced by our nonprofit Grassland Groupies, dedicated to educating the world about these beautiful biomes. We will be back in 1 month with another terrific and educational episode. In the meantime, write us a review, leave us some feedback, get in touch with us on the socials. We want to hear from you. And until then, farewell.
Farewell. Okay, here we go. I got this.
Yeah. Whew.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Best Biome, where we take a look. I know it's not right. That's fine. Who cares?
You could have just gone.
Okay. Oh, one more time.
I don't remember what it is anymore.
Hello from your favorite Grasslands PR team.
This week we're back. Okay.
Let's do that without shouting.
Yes.
Good energy though.
Thank you. All right.
Hello from your favorite Grasslands PR team. This week we're back with, this month, we're back with another episode.
We're having a week. It's a week.
Last chance. Last chance. Here we go.